Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy once again to have as our guest Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is a program we do every month, have been doing for a long time, to give folks a chance to ask home maintenance questions. Maybe there is some problem that has just come up. You're not quite sure how to deal with it. Something needs to be fixed. You're going to make some changes. You're going to do some remodeling. I'm sure that nowadays, this is not exactly new, but people, I think, are spending more and more time thinking about their energy use. Maybe you'd like to make your home more energy efficient. Whatever it is, Scott knows a lot about the various pieces and parts of the single-family home. So if you had a question, you give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good for folks who would ordinarily make a long-distance call, and we'll pay for it, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send in a question by email, you can do that too. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So any point here, you got questions? You give us a call. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I always love to come out here.
A little bit off our usual schedule. It's usually a Monday. We were off yesterday, and we didn't want to go a whole month, so we figured let's just bump it over one day. And
yeah, I tried to confuse me there. I don't know.
Well, maybe other people are confused, too. I don't know. We'll see. We do have somebody who is all lined up and ready to go. In Champaign, let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. Thanks.
I have a problem with my bathtub shower in that there's cold water now leaking from the shower head. And I've been told that the valve or whatever it is in the wall and the tile will have to come down in order to replace or repair this. And it's a 40-plus-year-old system.
Okay, and probably not.
Probably not. Oh, goody.
Yes, this one I might actually have some good news for. Most of the time, the shower valve can be replaced from the front. Now, is it a single handle or two handle?
Two handle.
Two handle. All right. Usually what you do is you turn off the water and you take the handle off, and then the stem itself will unscrew, and there's a valve seat and a valve seal. The seal is usually a piece of rubber, and the seat is a piece of brass. If it's been leaking very long, you may actually have to replace the piece of brass, which requires either an Allen wrench or a square-headed fixture to put in there, and you can, most seats are removable. You can actually put this Allen wrench, or if it's a square, you put this square piece in there and back it out and replace the seat and the seal. The parts, about $6.
Wow.
The labor to put it in, $75 to park in the driveway.
Right.
In other words, if you call somebody, it's going to be a minimum service charge of about $75. Minimum,
okay.
But you should be able to do it. If the shower valve it truly needs to be replaced, then yes, you have to get back into the wall, or you go in from the backside, where you, if the shower butts up to a closet or something like that, oftentimes it's just as easy to cut the drywall from the backside rather than it is to replace the tile from the front side.
Okay, the rest of my question is, should I need to get into the wall? Obviously, the tile will have to be removed. Do I hire a plumber and then someone else to do the tile removal and replacement?
Well, then again, depending on where the wall is, you may not need to take the tile off the wall. You might be able to get it to the wall from behind, because most of the time a shower is on a plumbing wall of some sort and it backs up to a closet. Usually you can get to it from the behind, from the back side of the shower.
Ours backs up to a second bathroom, the shower to the other.
Oh, so bathroom. The two showers back up, back to back?
Back to back.
Okay, yep, so you got to figure out which one. Most plumbers will be able to open it up and get it at least partially sealed back up, and you may need a tile guy to come back in and put the tile back in.
Okay.
But they're able to get in and get to the problem and get the problem repaired. Whether or not it can put it back together to your standard is something else. You may need a professional to finish the job, but they should be able to get it started and at least get the plumbing working properly.
Okay. Can we talk about the kitchen sink, too?
Sure.
I have a new assembly, you know, the faucet and the handles, and it's the old-fashioned kind where there are two things to work your hands, and then a sprayer is separate. And when I use the sprayer, an equal amount of water is running out of the faucet just as fast as it can. I mean, mm-hmm. The sprayer works great, but there's a lot of waste water. Should it be like that or not?
No, usually there is a check valve on the sprayer hose, which actually is supposed to, when you hit the sprayer and release the pressure at the sprayer end, it's supposed to block the water at the other end to the faucet, so the faucet effectively shuts off, or at least most of it. It sounds to me like you got a piece of sediment or a piece of dirt in there. Usually it's a matter of taking the hose off and either replacing or cleaning the check valve that's right up underneath the faucet itself. But that is also a fairly common and repairable item. But then again, we also have to stop and think, well, by the time I pay the plumber to come out here and do all that, you can almost buy a new one for about $100, $130. It may be just as easy to install a whole new assembly with a new faucet and a new sprayer and the whole works.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much. I'll tell you, I once had the experience of trying to replace a valve seat. And I'll tell you, first of all, you have to have a valve seat wrench, which you'll never use again. And then the big problem that I had was figuring out what size I needed to buy to do the replacement. And as you know, there are 50,000 different, you go to the hardware place, you know, you could go all day looking at different valve seats. Is there any trick to figuring out what it is when you get the replacement part, what it is you need?
No. Okay. I wish there was. I could make my fortune. No, you're absolutely correct, because every manufacturer comes up with a slightly different system.
Yeah, yeah.
There are literally hundreds of valve seats out there. You cross your fingers that you have one of the more common ones that is available at like one of the big box stores or one of the local hardware stores. Definitely take it apart first and take it with you and actually let them look at it and see what it is. Usually if you're, like say, one of the big box stores, you're kind of going through shelves by yourself. If you go to a local hardware store, usually they'll have somebody come over there that with a little bit of knowledge to kind of wander through there and help you figure out which piece you need. But yeah, the valve seat tool, the square one, yeah, it's something you probably are never going to use again.
Yeah.
But luckily it's only an $8 or $9 tool.
Yeah, that's true.
Like I say, some of them are hex or Allen's headed, so six-sided.
Yeah.
So you
yeah.
can look in there with your flashlight and determine whether or not a standard set of Allen wrenches will take it out.
Okay. On again, let's talk with some folks in Urbana. Next, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Yes.
I recently had a radon abatement system put in, and it did the trick. I mean, we had it well over four, whatever, six or something, and it's down to like 0.08. So my concern, however, is that I can definitely see and feel and hear air being sucked out of the basement through the floor drains, and that means that if air is being sucked out of the house through the radon pump, that means that cold air is being sucked into the house. And so the question is there a way of doing this, keeping the house, without adding cold air coming into the house, keeping the house sealed?
No, if you're pulling air out, you have to put air back in, otherwise it implodes.
Right, I understand that. But
yeah, you've got to have air coming in somewhere. They do make air-to-air heat exchanger systems for extremely tight houses where we can do an air exchange without losing heat or without losing much heat. But the cost factor and the installation factor on those usually far outweighs any energy savings you could possibly save. Now, I am a little concerned that you hear your radon coming through your drains, because the radon system, they should have connected it to usually a sump pump system.
Right.
And your sump pump should not be doing your floor drains. And even then, your floor drain should have a water trap. And so you should not actually be hearing the air coming through the drains. If you've got a floor drain that's making that noise, try dumping a bucket of water in there and make sure that the trap hasn't dried out.
Okay. Well, I know that the floor drain does drain into the sump pump and the radon.
Right, but there should be a trap, and the trap should be full of water, so you should not be getting odors from the sump pump back to the drain. Now, obviously,
where is that bend put? It's supposed to be put.
It's usually within 2 to 3 inches of the drain itself, so right there in the middle of the floor.
Ah, and that's all in poured concrete.
In poured concrete, yes.
Ha!
Yeah.
No, there's a clear shot there because I can hear air going through, so I don't think there is any trap.
Well, try and dump a bucket of water in there and see if that fills a trap. That may or may not do it. If not, they're not. Ideally, the floor drains should have been trapped so that any odors from the sewer system or from the sump pump are not coming back into the basement, because the sump pump doesn't always smell fresh. However, with your radon system, you should not have a problem with odors coming back because it is drawing a negative draft. Unfortunately, it means that the more is drawing from your drain, the less it's drawing from the substrate underneath your concrete, which is what it's supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be pulling that radon from underneath the concrete floor.
Right.
And if it's
yeah.
pulling it through your drains, then it's not being as effective as it should.
Yeah, and putting sort of another tube someplace to let the sump pull air so it wouldn't come out. I mean, putting another one from outside on the other side of the house, that wouldn't make any sense either then, right? Because you're not...
No, because now you're negating your vacuum yeah. effect of your radon system, and
yeah.
so it's not drawing okay. the radon out.
Okay, I'll check those water traps. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And that's I think that's really a good tip. People have drains in their floors in their basement. If they're lucky enough and they're never getting any water in their basement, chances are probably pretty good that the traps in those eventually are going to dry out because nothing's going to go in there.
That does happen,
and
yes.
then that's where you get bad smells. That's what the purpose of having that water in the trap is, to keep air and odors from coming back. So every once in a while, if you just put a little water in there, make sure your traps are full, that should take care of that problem.
Yeah, and there is another trick of it. After you pour the water in there, if that is what the problem is, you can then put about a teaspoon of cooking oil down the drain, and what that does is it'll sit on top of the water and help reduce the evaporation of the water in the trap.
There you go.
So it'll stay wet longer.
All right. Another Urbana person here. This is line three.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling to ask a question about attic windows. And I have an attic with a small window in the north end and another one in the south end. And, of course, I keep them open in the summer. But I don't know whether I should keep it partly. Well, I've been keeping it partly open about 2 inches in the winter. But somebody else, a carpenter, told me I should close them up completely in the winter. So which is right?
Well, it kind of depends on how much additional ventilation you have in the attic. The attic should have good ventilation year-round. In the summertime, people are thinking, hey, we need to get the heat out of there. What we really need to worry about is the wintertime getting humidity out. When you're normal living in the house, cooking, cleaning, showering, you're putting moisture in the house. That moisture will tend to move through walls, floors, doors, ceilings, etc. And so you end up with some excess moisture in the attic area. And if you don't vent that out, we can end up with frost or even mold and mildew problems in the attic. So attic ventilation is very, very important. The only ventilation you have for that attic area are the windows, then yes, I would say you are doing the correct thing by leaving them open a couple of inches to get some air moving through there. If there's additional ventilation, a roof vent, a ridge vent, along with some soffit ventilation, then you can probably close them up. The problem with the window is occasionally we can get some rain or snow blowing in through them because they're a little bit larger opening than most vents and they're not really designed to be protected from the elements. However, like I say, if you don't have a roof vent or you don't have a ridge vent, then yes, I would recommend leaving those windows open just a little bit as you've been doing.
Well, they're small windows. They're like, 3 feet by a foot and a half or something like that. And, well, it seems to me I'm doing the right thing by leaving them a little bit open.
Yes, it does sound like that. See, the attic really is not affecting the house as much as a lot of people think. Hot air rises. So what happens is your hot air from your house goes up and warms the attic. Well, we don't really need to warm the attic. We want the attic to be ventilated to keep the humidity levels down. A warm attic does not make for a warm house. However, some people are in the mindset that if we get the attic too hot, that it increases our cooling load. Well, that's true, but that's only true if you don't have enough insulation. If you have the proper amount of insulation, again, heat rising, so the hot attic is not trying to warm the floor below it, the level below it, but it's trying to get out of the house. So what you need is a little bit more...
pretty cold up there in the winter.
In the wintertime, yes. I like ventilation year-round for the attic. We need to keep ventilation for getting heat out and getting moisture out in the summertime, and in the wintertime, definitely need it for getting moisture out. So, yes, I think you're doing it correctly by leaving it open.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, very good. We'll go on here to another caller, have some other folks. Just let me tell you very quickly, our guest in this hour is Scott Spies. He's an inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on the program once a month, usually on a Monday, to do this program on home maintenance. And if you have a question, give us a call. You can call 333-9455 if you're in Champaign-Urbana. The toll-free line, 800-222-9455. You can also send an email, will-talk at illinois.edu. The next person is in DeWitt County, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yeah.
I added on to remodeled a house in 1982. Still have the same water heater and the same air conditioner. They're both still working. The air conditioner I just try not to use unless it's blistering hot, but sometime I'm going to have to replace that, and I'm sure it'll be a huge improvement. And the water heater hasn't blown up yet, but I'm wondering, what's your thinking about like a tankless water heater, or am I just as well off just getting a standard? I'm on natural gas pipeline, so you know that's a nice way to go. So the first question is about the water heater. What should I replace it with?
Well, the tankless is a nice option because we are not holding water at temperature. However, most of the newer water heaters, the standard water heaters, have enough insulation that we're really not losing that much heat out of them. I generally say if you're building new and it's a house that's not used on a regular basis, like a vacation home or one or two person, then the tankless can work quite well. If you've got three or four people living in the house, you're using the hot water often enough that I don't know that the tankless is actually going to help you out significantly versus the cost. Now, if you're going to be in there for 15 or 20 years, that's a different story. If I was building new, I would definitely be trying to look into the tankless type systems because I can actually plumb it such that it will be very efficient. When you try and retrofit an existing plumbing system with the tankless, just swapping out into the position of a standard unit, you don't necessarily have the optimum piping or the optimum distribution from the tankless system to make it work well. In other words, you can have some pretty long runs, so you ask for that instant hot water, and it may take quite a while. It's got to run an awful lot of hot water to try and keep up.
Yeah,
so it does vary from situation to situation. If you've already got a standard water heater in there and a replacement water heater is $200 and a tankless system is $600 or $700, you're going to have to save an awful lot of energy to cover the cost of installation because they're going to have to redo the piping. So just the cost of the unit is going to be almost triple of a standard water heater. And the cost of installation is probably going to just about triple as well. Because they're going to have to change a lot of the piping and redo things, so you're going to end up trying to figure out how you're going to save close to $1,000. And to be quite honest, I don't think you can save that much if your yearly hot water bill is your energy use for your hot water is $300 to $400. If you were to use no hot water, it's still going to take 4 years to recover.
Right. Okay. And the other thing was about the air conditioner unit. I could just replace it with a newer. And larger, that would help too because I added on to the house. But
now, is it separate from the heating system?
Yes.
Is it attic mounted or is it mounted in a crawl space / basement?
It's on the ground level. The condenser coil is with. I mean, it's hooked in with the furnace.
Okay.
So
it shares a common ductwork.
Right. Right.
Okay.
So. Should I just get, a newer, higher efficiency unit, two-stage or whatever? Or is there any point trying to get more out of the system, like with a heat pump type arrangement? Because I think in our climatic zone, that would be kind of questionable because it tends to stay so much colder. Is there any advantage one over the other?
Well, there again, if you're talking about a heat pump, doing a retrofit on a heat pump, it's quite expensive. And a heat pump will provide heat down to about 25 degrees outside, and then we need to switch to an auxiliary system, which is generally electric but could be natural gas or LP. And then it works much more in line with the gas system you've got now. I would have to say that if you've already, you've already got a HVAC system, a standard system, and you've got a older compressor connected to it, your best bet is to end up with a newer high-efficiency compressor, particularly if your compressor is more than about 15 years old, 15 or 18 years old.
Yeah, it
would,
it is.
Yeah, it would probably have a SEER rating or seasonal energy efficiency rating of somewhere between 6 and 10. And right now they're not allowed to sell anything less than 13. So you end up with a 13 to 15 SEER rating. This SEER rating, the S-E-E-R, is actually the number of BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity used. So if you switch from a 6 BTUs per watt unit to a 13 BTUs per watt unit, you just knocked your air conditioning bill in half or more.
Wow.
Just by putting in a newer unit.
Yeah.
So the high efficiency ones, I mean, it is definitely the strides that we've made in improving cooling systems on houses in the last 25 years has just been amazing. Of course, the 25 years before that, they were using ice blocks, so that was pretty good too. So we've definitely moved up from there. So yes, cooling. I would have to say cooling homes is a relatively new industry because that we really didn't start doing it till 50 or 60 years ago, and so what we've got now is much better. So if you've got a unit that's more than about 15 or 18 years old, yeah, I'd probably just leave the system you've got now and put in the higher efficiency compressor.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. I think cooling with ice blocks, wouldn't you have some kind of dampness problems? Isn't it kind of a damp cool?
But most of the time, the people that did that were the really hot areas where the humidity level may not have been quite as high. But, well, still today, we rate air conditioners in tons. How many ton air conditioner do we have? Okay, a ton air conditioner is the equivalent of melting 2,000 pounds of ice.
That's what the ton refers to, actually, is ice?
It's ice. Okay, hey, how much cooling do I get out of 2,000 pound block of ice? So if I need a 3-ton air conditioner, it's a house that in a 24-hour period would melt 6,000 pounds of ice. So that's still the rating that we're using
I did not know that. I'm happy to know that. Well, let's go on here and talk to some other folks. Back to Urbana and line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yes. Should I run my sump pump periodically?
Is there water in it?
No.
Okay. It doesn't hurt to click it on and off, depending on how humid the sump pump is. I've seen sumps that were dusty bone dry, and the pumps don't have any problem. I've seen others that just have a little bit of condensation, just a dampness. And if you let it sit for too long, then we can get some rust, and it doesn't want to work. So it does not hurt to reach down there and flip the switch once in a while just to make sure that it is functional. Because let's face it, when you do need it, you're going to need it right now, not 20 minutes from now. It's going to need it because you got water. So it's not a bad idea to periodically reach down there, flip the switch or the float or whatever it takes to turn it on, and make sure that it does operate.
Okay, and would you have a general idea what the R value of a standard pane of glass is? Window?
Almost nothing.
It's
in the 1 to 2 range. Even a high efficiency glass is usually in the 4 to 7 range. So it's still really low. So when they're talking high efficiency window, it's all relative.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
it's high efficiency relative to another window, but it's not high efficiency relative to a door or a bat of insulation or anything like that. Glass transfers. Now, the fun part about glass is it does transfer heat, but it does it when air moves past the glass. So if we have a dead air space, a storm window to prevent moving air, a dual pane where we end up with a small gap, then that dead air space or lack of airflow past the window reduces the amount of heat that will transfer through it. But if you've got a single pane and the cold air is able to drop down, warm air come from the top, yeah, you can lose a lot of heat out of it, like, say, R value of 1 to 2.
It would seem to pay to insulate your attic if it's just the heat's going to go up there and then flow out the sides.
Yeah. Insulating, if you've got a well-insulated attic and a well-insulated wall, and a minimum 3.5-inch insulation, then, of course, we move to our next big heat loss. That would be crawl space or band joists in a basement. So it's all relative. You can put 30 inches insulation in your attic, and if you haven't got more than a R7 or R13 in the wall, you're going to still lose a lot of heat. Insulation has, I like to look at it, it has its points where it pays back and where it doesn't. You can over-insulate an area and not see much of an energy increase because that wasn't your major heat loss. Someplace else is your heat loss. There are several companies in the area that are doing what we call energy audits, and they can come in and use blower doors or thermal cameras and see where your house is losing the most heat. And obviously, you're going to save the most energy by fixing the biggest hole, not the small one. If you've got R30 in the attic, to raise it to an R55 is probably not going to be cost-effective because that's not your major heat loss at this point in time.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. And to another Urbana person, this is line two. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question for you. I had a new picture window installed in this fall, and I thought it was leaking, but then I realized it's condensation. And it's not only the new one. All of my picture windows are getting condensation along the sill. And even the skylight had a condensation dripping from it. Why is winter different, and why is it doing that?
You have a very high humidity level in the house. Or too high, not very high, but too high. Relatively humid.
Yeah,
and so the windows are the coldest spots in the house, and so that is where the water will start to condense. A couple things that can happen. First of all, this winter, I'm almost afraid to call it a winter. We really haven't hit winter weather yet, so I'm afraid to call it winter. But what's happened is we'll have days like today where it is 45 degrees and raining out there, or 40 degrees and raining. So it's very, very humid. Then we'll get a cold snap. Typical Illinois is going to drop 25 degrees. Well, the moisture is already in your house because of the humidity outdoors, and all of a sudden we get a quick temperature drop. Now the house is relatively high in humidity versus outdoors, because outdoors it all froze and fell out, and so you can end up with some condensation. If it's just a one- or two-time thing right at the beginning of winter when things are still damp, I would recommend turning on a bathroom fan for a couple hours. Try and pull some moisture out. If it's something that you see every time the temperature drops, we need to figure out where the humidity level is in your house. Why do we have high humidity? Start looking for moisture on a vapor barrier in a crawl space, a bathroom vent fan that's no longer working, a fish tank that you should put a cover over the top of, a humidifier that you've got set too high, things like that. When we start getting water on dual pane glass, such as your new picture window, it's an indication the humidity level in the house is too high. So we need to find where the water's coming from.
Okay. Who would I contact to figure that out? Like a handyman sort of?
Well, that again, you're probably going to find somebody that's in the home inspection profession to be a little bit more informed on moisture and moisture sources than most handymen. Now, I'm not going to say all of them because some of them are very good. But as a general rule, what you're looking for is not somebody to tell you, hey, I can fix this, but somebody to say, hey, you should get this fixed. In other words, a home inspector doesn't make money by finding the problem, so he has no stake in what he looks for. He looks for everything. So, yes, I would suggest getting somebody to come out and do a maintenance call. Just come out and look at the house and see if you can figure out, hey, how can I make it a little bit more energy efficient, and I have this moisture problem to take a look at and see if they can figure out what's causing the high humidity.
In the interim, I could use a dehumidifier. I think I have an old one.
You could run a dehumidifier, or you could turn a bathroom or kitchen vent fan on, provided they're vented to the outside, and let them run for a couple hours.
Okay.
Something like that.
I'll do that.
Yep. Just pulling the air out of the house, and once it dries out, obviously when it's raining outside, drawing more air from outside is not going to help your humidity level in the house. But once it gets cold and you start getting the condensation, you can turn a fan on.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thank you. This morning in this part of Focus, we're talking with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do these programs once a month to give you the chance to ask questions about home maintenance, and we'll talk some more in just a second. Coming up in hour two of the show, another of our monthly how-tos, Sandy Mason will be here. This is our monthly program on things that grow in the home landscape. You have questions about the things that grow in your yard, houseplants, we can do that too. She's here every month to do that show. And also as a special guest this time around, we'll have joining us Charlotte Edelman. She is a co-author of the book, The Midwestern Native Garden and Illustrated Guide, which is a really nice book for people who are interested in having more native plants in their home landscape. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest is Alex Shekar. He's a professor in the English department here at the U of I. He teaches creative writing, and we'll talk about his new novel, Luminarium, which is a very interesting exploration of a religious experience and what it's all about and where it comes from. And then tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour, Stephen Cohen will be here. He's a senior fellow in foreign policy at the 21st Century Defense Initiative, was for many years professor of political science here at the University of Illinois, and someone who has been for a long time following politics in Pakistan and India. He'll be here visiting, and we will talk about Pakistan and current events there. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions, and you can check on the schedule, find out what we'll will be doing by going to our website, and that is will.illinois.edu. And this morning, in this part of Focus, Scott Spies is the guest. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. And if you got a problem, a maintenance problem around the house, you need some advice, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Back to the phones, and we have some Champaign folks up next. Line 3 is the next person right here. Hello.
Problem with my heating system. My house is 50 years old, and I have a boiler, and the pipes run in the ceiling, and there's another house across the street from me that has this same sort of heating system, and an engineering guy from the U of I told me, yeah, this is a great way to heat your house. It warms your body. It warms objects. It doesn't warm the air. Well, my level payment for heat and electricity is $184 a month, and I don't run the air conditioner in the summer. I had to go to level payments because I sometimes have $400, $500 heating bills. Mm-hmm. I keep my house set at about 65. I'm wondering if, because the house is 50 years old, whether the pipes need to be bled. I remember that with old boilers and radiators, that every now and then the radiators had to be bled. Do you think that that would help at all?
Do you have certain rooms that are cold, or the house just in general?
The whole house is cold.
Then bleeding one or two systems is not going to do it. Yes, the old radiators used to get what we call air rot.
I don't have radiators.
Right. You've got what we call a radiant heat system.
Right.
A ceiling-mounted radiant heat system.
Right.
And my guess is we just have enough energy loss through the rest of the house that your radiant heat system, you have to set it up higher that to where it costs you more money to operate. Probably one of the energy audits to figure out where your heat loss is would be a very wise choice for your particular situation.
Yeah.
Now, your boiler, 50 years old, is probably still chugging along.
No, it's I got a new one in 91, or even later than that. It's about 20 years old, I think.
Okay, that's a good thing. Because the old ones would have been about 40 to 50% efficient, and the new ones are 85 to 90% efficient. So we end up with a little higher efficiency boiler. Now, a lot of times the higher efficiency boilers will have a little bit lower operating temperature because they're more efficient. They figure they can pump more water at a lower temperature. And so it may actually reduce the effectiveness of your radiant heat. They may need to bump the operating temperature of the system so that your radiant heat system is a little bit warmer so it works more efficiently at warming the objects in the room, such as yourself. But like I say, an energy audit would probably be a wise choice in your particular house because it is old enough. There are going to be areas where you are losing some heat. And the radiant heat, while it does warm the objects, yourself, the furniture, etc., there is still heat loss in the house, which is why you're feeling cold. And so figuring out where that heat is going out means that you don't feel as cold. So then, obviously, you become warmer.
Yeah.
I would say
I have new siding. I've tried everything. I have all new windows. I'm on a crawl space, and it's so shallow that I'm not sure that anybody could get under there to insulate. But I'll do that. I'll have the energy audit come out.
Yeah, it's not cheap, but they're not terribly expensive. Usually they will save you more money in the long run by finding where the air leaks are and stopping them up and finding where your heat loss is and adding some more insulation. And so generally speaking, it does pay pretty well.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Very good. And to another caller, this is also Champaign, line 1.
Good morning. I have a question about possibly inspecting wiring in a house. And, a while ago, a house in the neighborhood burnt down to the ground, and evidently there was a wiring issue, and the house is the same age as the rest of the neighborhood, 15 to 20 years old, and the rest of us are wondering, do we have something sitting someplace that we should be concerned about? And I'm not even sure how it's done and how cost-effective it is. So what is your opinion?
Generally, 15 to 20 years old, you're running a Romex. There really shouldn't be too many wiring issues. Kind of depends on the area you're in, how stringent they were on their building codes and their building inspections as the house was being built. You have current wiring. In other words, the wiring you're using is Romex, which is the same thing you're putting in today's houses. Now, of course, the quality of the wiring is not necessarily reflective of the quality of the installation of the wiring. In other words, who wired it? If there was something that had a wiring issue, I would have to say from experience that most of the time when somebody had a wiring issue that caused a fire, it was something that was added on afterwards and not something that the builder did. Somebody added an electric fireplace, or somebody added a sauna, and it was the additional electrical work was probably not done by a licensed electrician that caused the problem. Most of the time, the original wiring is not the issue. I can't say 100% because everybody's a little bit different, and each electrician does things a little bit different. You could get a home inspector to come out and do a general look. In other words, pull the covers on the box, the main service panel, and look at things, make sure it looks like that's wired correctly, got the proper grounds, got the proper breakers connected to proper size wiring, and take a quick look at any additions to the house. If somebody added the hot tub or somebody put in a sauna, little things like that, were those additions added to the box correctly? You could get an electrician to come in and do a little walk around. The problem with the electrician is he's going to be probably a little better versed than the home inspector, but he's also going to want to probably do more repairs. The home inspector can say, well, this isn't quite up to code, but this is not a code inspection, so you don't necessarily need to do it. Where an electrician comes in and sees it, and he's like, well, you're going to have to do this, or I'm going to need to do that. Either one is probably a good alternative to sitting there doing nothing. But I don't know that I would lose sleep over it, because my guess is most of the wiring in the house and most of the houses in the neighborhood don't have a problem, that the fire was actually caused by something that was added on later.
Okay, well, that's a little bit of peace of mind.
Yeah, like I say, if your house is 15 to 20 years old, it's wired with Romex wiring, and that is the current standard in downstate Illinois. Now, you get up to Chicago, that's not allowed. It's illegal. They want everything in conduit. But that's more of a political problem than it is a safety problem. So everything downstate from Chicago is done in Romex. And that's what you've got, is a Romex cable, just because that's what they started using in the mid-70s. And so your house isn't old enough to have anything older than that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, very good. Thank you. We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month, usually on a Monday, to talk about home maintenance. We have maybe about 12 or 13 minutes left, so plenty of time for questions. If you have some kind of problem, not quite sure how to deal with it, give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Bloomington, line 2. Hello.
Yeah, I've got one large garage door and one single garage door. I'm wondering if it's worth insulating those garage doors with those kits that are available nowadays.
Does the garage actually have a heat source?
No.
Okay, then it's not going to do a whole lot, because the only heat source, the only really warming effect you're getting is going to be your concrete slab. The slab is in contact with the soil and will stay about 50 to 55 degrees. So you do have a little bit of a heat source, but since your garage should be insulated from the rest of the house, basically your house walls that are adjoining the garage don't ever see outdoor temperature. They see the garage temperature, and the garage temperature is going to be warmer than outdoor temperature. So since you're not actually heating the garage and you don't actually have a heat source, any insulation of the garage doors is going to be a minimal efficiency improvement.
Okay, thank you.
It does help keep the ice and snow melting off the cars and things like that, because a well-insulated garage, even without a heat source, will usually stay above freezing because of the heat source from the concrete floor. But since there's nothing heating in that, it's probably not going to affect the house much. They would have, when they built it, or should have when they built it, insulated the walls between the house and the garage. So the garage is already much warmer than it is outdoors. You know, if it's 20 degrees outside, the garage is probably still over 40. So those walls are not seeing direct outdoor temperature. So increasing the garage temperature to 50 from 40 is really not going to make much difference in your energy use.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks. In a situation like that, is it really worth, though, just paying attention to what say you got a door into the garage, what that door is made of? Is the door insulated? Is the rough opening that the door is in too tight, so you're not getting air leakage around there?
It kind of depends on the age of the house, again, because the current requirements are that we have a 20-minute fire-rated door between the house and the garage.
Oh, okay.
And so those are insulated, and they are weather-stripped and have a threshold. If the house has been added on to, somebody's done some changes, put a glass window in it where they can see out in the garage, or an older house, then yes, that could be an issue, making sure that our door between the house and the garage is sealed. But anything in the last, I'd say, 25 to 30 years probably already has a really good sealing door, or at least had a really good sealing door before somebody did something to it.
Okay. Next caller is Muhammad, line 3.
Yes, good morning.
Hi,
Scott. We have cedar siding on the outside of our house, and it needs painting again. And so I'm thinking about maybe putting vinyl, you know, siding on the outside of it. What's the cost effectiveness there, and what types of siding are there?
Well, there's just about everything. Vinyl siding is the more prevalent at this point in time because of the ease of installation and the longevity of the vinyl itself. Vinyl does deteriorate with sunlight, so as you get vinyl siding that's getting in the 35 to 40 year range, it's starting to get more and more brittle, so it tends to crack and break, and you try and fix it and it wants to fall apart rather than come apart. So it does have a finite life, whereas your cedar siding has an almost infinite life. Cedar siding, as long as it's maintained, it's not uncommon to find it 50, 60, 70 years old and still in pretty good shape. You use the word painting, which set off a red flag. Thank you. Cedar siding does not paint well. You want to stain the cedar siding. Yes. I doubt that you're going to see much improvement in energy by putting new siding over the top of what you've got. The siding is actually not your insulating material. The wall is. It will help a little bit, and it reduces some of the air loss if you put another layer of siding on the house, but it also creates a whole slew of other problems, such as how do I get my windows to meet the vinyl siding, since the vinyl siding sticks out farther if it's put over the cedar. If you pull the cedar off, then you're actually not getting any improvement by going to vinyl siding, because the cedar siding is probably more of an insulator than the vinyl siding. If you put the vinyl over the cedar, then you've got to start worrying about flashing issues, because now your vinyl sticks out around windows. You got to figure out how to flash things to keep water from getting in behind it. So I'd have to say, from an energy standpoint, I'm not sure that vinyl siding would help you. From an expense, how often do I have to stain it versus a vinyl siding, which is lower little maintenance, lower no maintenance. And it all depends on how much it's costing you to get it stained, how big the house is, whether or not it's more effective. You could put the vinyl siding on, and that would probably replace 3 to 4 stainings on the cedar siding. So as long as, you know, the vinyl siding is less than what it cost you to stain it 4 times, then it may be a cost-effective solution there.
Thank you.
All right. And again, we thank you, and we'll go to Champagne for the next caller. Line 1. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. I've got a, a concrete block wall that's been sort of used as a fence wall kind of thing. It's about 30 inches high, and it's been stucco washed over it.
Okay.
And on one side of the wall, it's completely exposed and above ground. On the other side, there's kind of dirt back the elevation of the.
So effectively a short retaining wall.
That's right. Part of it is, anyway. It's about, this one particular section is about 20 feet long, and about 10 of it gradually gets further and further underground, so to speak, on one side.
Mm-hmm.
So in that area, we've sort of dug out a trench 8 or 10 inches wide and put river rock in there. But still in that area seems to really be sort of some cracking and so forth on the side that we can see. I'm wondering, is there something, some kind of sealer? Maybe I should get that rock out of there and seal that one side of the wall and then put the rock back in, or is there a different type of fill that you might want to put in there?
Is this a concrete block, a hollow concrete block, or is this a solid concrete block?
Some of each, actually, but mainly hollow.
Well, it's not uncommon to get some movement in a masonry retaining wall, because the soil on the backside of the retaining wall expands and contracts with temperature, freezing, thawing, with humidity levels, things like that. So you have some movement behind that wall, and unless it's got some vertical reinforcement in it, you are going to get some movement and some cracks. I would have to say that a concrete retaining wall is not, again, an infinite material. It's something that has to be replaced once in a while or has to be reinforced.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Putting a A sealer on the exposed side really doesn't do much because the moisture is coming from the side that's got the soil on it.
Right.
And so all you do by putting a sealer on the exposed side is trap moisture in the concrete, and then we get the freeze-thaw cycle, and we can actually do more damage to the block than if we were to actually let it breathe and let the water out of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming your cracks are mostly in the mortar joints, but occasionally you get a block that's cracked?
Mainly just in the joints. Up to this mm-hmm. point, it's only four or five years old. So.
Yeah, so it's a movement issue where your soil on the backside is expanding and tracting.
Yeah.
Sometimes it helps when they build the wall. This, obviously, if you end up rebuilding it, to put a 2-inch styrofoam backer board behind the foam and put the dirt up against that. That way, when the soil expands and contracts, it actually crushes and moves with the styrofoam rather than forcing up against the rigid mm-hmm. retaining wall.
Yeah.
And you can reduce some of the movement. But
on the backside, again, we've got about an 8-inch wide trench filled with river rock and that sort of thing, about golf ball size and smaller. Is that taking up any of that pressure that the solid dirt would be pushing there? Apparently not.
Well, my question is there anything keeping the water from soaking into the gravel? In other words, you've got the gravel on there, but is there a plastic line or a drain system?
No, there's not.
Okay, so all that is doing is allowing the water to soak in behind the wall.
Yeah.
So if anything, it may be hurting it more than anything else because we're allowing water to actually collect in effectively a moat alongside the back side of this wall.
So at this point, could we just take that rock out of there and adhere some of the styrofoam?
Probably the styrofoam's not going to work unless we get it really close to the bottom of the wall from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
My guess would be to help extend the life if you were to pull the gravel out. Line the trench, the opening, with plastic, put in a perforated drainage tile and take it to an end, hopefully downhill, to let it drain, and then put the gravel back over the top of it. Now it would end up as a drain system to help keep the soil directly below that gravel dry instead of keeping it wet. Right now, water runs the gravel, finds the gravel, soaks down, and keeps the soil next to the retaining wall wet. If we had a plastic liner in it and had a drain system, now we'd have this dry soil area underneath that, which would help reduce the amount of expansion and contraction with freezing, thawing, and moisture level, and probably help the pressure against the back of the wall.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
All right. Very good. We have a couple of minutes left. Oh, I think we have one more caller here. We'll do at least. And somebody wants to call real quick. We'll try. Can't promise. We'll try to get him in. 333-9455. Toll free. 800-222-9455. Another Champagne person here. Line number two.
Yeah.
Hi.
Could you say something about, it seems to me that there's a need for these sort of people that you are. And where do they get trained? Do the community colleges do this sort of thing? Could you say something about the education of people who are very helpful as yourself?
Well, that's a good question. There are classes for taking the home inspection licensing and stuff for the state of Illinois and for the state of Indiana. The classes do provide some really good information. However, the person taking the classes has to have a very high mechanical aptitude. You have to be able to look at things. Okay, which direction is this force? And most people want to go on into engineering rather than just into inspection. So it's kind of hard to keep a good inspector. An engineer can't go out and look at houses without having to effectively put his engineering stamp on it. So an inspector has to be somebody that has got a good mechanical grasp on forces, engineering background, but not an engineer. So it is hard to find somebody that can look at this stuff and really figure out what's going on without walking in. I've run into this before where home inspectors come in and say, well, we need to get an expert to look at this, and we need to get an expert to look at that, and we need to get an expert. And it's like, okay, why are you here? Why didn't I get a couple of experts to begin with? So to get somebody that can give you a good overview without having to say, ooh, well, I don't know, we'll have to call somebody, it's kind of tough to find. I know I got lucky. My father was with the University of Illinois Small Homes Council, Building Research Council, for 35 years. And so from the time I was 14 on up, our family vacations included going to look at buildings that were falling down. So I kind of got in on the ground floor. And the school of experience has definitely helped out. I have been to some inspector training classes and been to the Property Inspector Training Institute out in Virginia and did learn some stuff. So there are classes for that, But experience is experience. Doing an apprenticeship with another inspector that's been in business for a while is always a good way to learn things. You're absolutely correct. It's kind of interesting to find out where we can get that information, but I don't have a good answer for that.
Thank you.
All right. And I guess if you're going to hire an inspector, two things you might want to ask him is how much experience, how long have you been doing this, and do you have the state certification?
You have to have the state certification to do a pre-purchase inspection. That's a law. So all the inspectors that you will find for buying and purchasing new homes and such, they will have the license. The license means that they passed a test. The test means that they had to have some knowledge. Now, it's a 200-question test. If you take a 6 or 8 week course, you probably pick up enough knowledge to be able to pass the test, but that doesn't mean you've ever been into a house. So, yes, you want to ask them, how many homes have you inspected? What is your background? When we get contractors coming in and becoming inspectors, they have a little bit better knowledge on, you know, how to put the house together, so therefore they know a little bit more what to look for. I don't want to knock home inspectors because there are a lot of very good ones out there, but I think Texas was one of the first places to ever license home inspectors. And one of the questions they put on their test is, what was your previous profession? Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, now, while I won't say it's like 50%, one of the higher majorities was hairdresser. Apparently somebody put in the back of one of these magazines how you could make extra money, full-time money working part-time, and it ended up in some magazines. And so these people took these classes, and they were not trained, were not even inclined in contracting, but they figured by taking these classes and getting a license, they could make extra money. So, yeah, you have to research your inspector before you run out there and just pick anybody.
Okay, well, we're going to have to quit. I'm sorry. We have one person we just can't take. Scott, we'll be back again next month. We'll be doing it again then. And it will be on the Monday. It'll
all
be
right,
the regular day.
To Mondays.
Scott Spies with the Spies Home Inspection Service. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David.